Good morning, YGLs. Hello, and welcome once again to this breakfast on Understanding Myanmar. It's wonderful to see all of you, and this is actually something that's going to be shared with the rest of the YGL community. This will all be recorded, so those who are not present this morning will be able to have an inside glimpse into the country and what's going on. We are super excited to hear from our guest speaker. I am also enthused because this is something that represents the spirit of the YGL community. This breakfast has been arranged by YGLs, and the longer-term conversation around the upcoming YGL Summit is something that has been put together by YGLs. This community is taking it upon itself to talk about not only understanding what's going on in the country, but what YGLs could and should do during the event and before the event and certainly after it as well. So I am really, really excited about that. Before we get started, I just want to make a few quick introductions. First, Rosanna Figuera, to all of the new YGLs, this is your YGL City Champion. And you certainly have heard from her in the last few weeks via email, and you will continue to hear from her in the coming months and year with YGL events, of which there are plenty in New York, as you know. And also just wanted to point out Kelly Payton from our North America team, who's based here in New York. As you know, I'm in Geneva, though I am the North America Community Manager. Kelly works with our North America team and is based here in New York and is a direct link to the World Economic Forum as well. So I know that she is another resource for the community based here. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Anu and to David and to hear from both of you. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you, Eric, and thank you, everybody, for coming. It was actually in this room when Klaus announced that our annual meeting will be in Burma. And I just remember the enthusiasm that was associated with that announcement. So now we are much closer to going there, and we thought it's time to start really getting prepared. We don't want to go there and without understanding really what the country is, what the opportunities are, and most importantly, if there's something that we as a community can do to make a difference. So I'm absolutely delighted to be able to welcome David Phillips, my colleague from Columbia University this morning. David is the director of the Program of Peace Building and Rights in the Institute for the Study of Human Rights. So he deals with a particularly tough regions and countries from all around the world, whether it's Syria right now, whether it's Sudan, and other places. So he has extensive experience both in researching these regions, spending a lot of time doing field work there. So recently, David has turned a lot of his attention to Burma and spent time there, and I have learned tremendously about Burma with my conversations with David. And he's the one who is leading Columbia University's efforts also to create a system-wide response under the guidance of our president to make sure that we can help and leverage the resources that we have to make a difference there. But David has kindly promised to bring us up to speed on what is going on in Burma, what are their greatest needs, what are the greatest challenges, what are the ways to contribute and move forward. So thank you so much for coming, David.
Thank you, Anna. It's great to be here. Thank you all for being in the room and all of the young global leaders from around the world. It's a pleasure to talk about Burma, which is really a bright story, a success story. There's a lot that's positive going on in Burma right now. There are also some very serious challenges. And Anu mentioned there was a story in the FT this morning about the shallow nature of reforms and some of the backsliding that could occur there. So now is the time to try to consolidate progress. The fact that you all are going in June and will be meeting Burmese, the fact that you have expertise and enthusiasm to try to help is really terrific. I hope as a result of our conversation this morning, we can identify some practical ways of enlisting you, certainly in service of Burma's democratic reform. Some of you might have had the chance last September to meet Aung San Suu Kyi when she was here in New York. I think you mentioned that you saw her at the Council on Foreign Relations. She came to Columbia, and she was just spellbinding. It's very rare that you meet a kind of Mandela or Gandhi-like figure, and she had the audience just in the palm of her hand. It was not long ago, just a couple of years ago, that she was under house arrest. So when you think about this sort of dramatic transition, not only for her personally, but for Burma, it really is like night and day. And somebody is going to write a very interesting book about the strategic pivot of Burma to the West. When we had lunch with her at Columbia, we talked about why Burma made the decision to start this reform process. And she thought it mostly had to do with economic issues. I'm sure that that's largely the case, but I think there's also a psychology that comes from being on sanctions list. You know, the military junta, which really led the reform process, couldn't travel, they couldn't invest, their children couldn't go overseas to study. So when you are the when you're the object of opprobrium over a long period of time, I think that has a very wearing effect on the psychology of a country. Now Burma is an entirely different place than when I visited for the first time 20 years ago, and even 2 years ago when Dah Soo was under house arrest. She's now been released from house arrest. There have been a dramatic series of political reforms. 600 political prisoners have been freed. There are still a couple hundred, so that is unfinished business, but it's real progress that so many are now out. There are new labor laws. Labor unions are in formation. There's a lot of civic mobilization and organizing that's underway. Burma was a very highly censored and closed society. Press censorship has been relaxed. The new regime has eliminated the press secretary and registration department, which was the primary vehicle for media control. These are dramatic steps for a country that had been so totally closed. Burma is truly open for business right now. It cleared arrears of the World Bank and Asian Development Bank debt. The Paris Club forgave its obligations. Japan canceled a $3 billion loan, $3 billion obligation. Norway did the same with a $500 million obligation. All told, it was able to write off $6 billion of its national debt, which represented 60% of its international obligation. And in the process of doing that, that cleared the way for new forms of donor assistance, from the Asian Development Bank, with Japan really riding herd on that process, from the World Bank as well. There's also been a series of legal reforms. It passed a foreign investment law in November. When you're in a developing country, you have people coming up to your car and trying to sell you wares. Rather remarkably, people come up with a copy of the foreign investment law trying to sell it to you. So it's pretty amazing that's happening, although we were told by our driver there was actually the old version of the foreign investment law. We weren't able to distinguish one from the other, but you know, the fact that this is going on, I think, is indication of just how far the society has come. Burma's also stepping up and thinking about its economic future. It's about to release a national development plan. That will include 4 5-year plans leading up to 2031. It's in the process of establishing 3 special economic zones. When President Thein Sein was in Europe last week, he announced the creation of the economic zones. It's signed on to the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative, and it's been amply rewarded for taking these steps. Burma became the chair of ASEAN for 2014. As a affirmation of all of this progress, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited Burma in December of 2011. She was the first Secretary of State to go there in more than 50 years. And then a year later, President Obama visited, the first American president ever to visit Burma. You know, always the University of Yangon had been the seat of activism. So during the worst years of the military junta, they essentially dismantled the university. The university was rehabilitated for Obama's trip. It was a bit of a Potemkin village university, but that was the site of his major address, an announcement of all kinds of new areas where the United States would be providing assistance. I think a catalyst for Obama's trip was the by-elections on the 1st of April of 2012. The National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, which had been banned heretofore, was allowed to run in those elections. It won 41 of the 44 seats that it contested. So clearly Aung San Suu Kyi is a cherished national figure. Her party is well regarded. But as Burma moves to consolidate its democratic development, how you transform from being an iconic dissident to being a national political leader is one of the areas challenges. So what I wanted to do is to just kind of highlight the progress, because Anu mentioned that I work in places like Syria and Sri Lanka and Sudan, and those are all extremely difficult places to work where the trends are heading in the wrong direction. The trends in Burma are all going in the right direction. When I went for my initial trip to launch our program in October, I sat down with one of the senior ministers, So Thein, and I reviewed the capabilities of the different schools at Columbia, and I asked him, where should we concentrate our efforts? And he said, everybody is welcome. Anything you can offer, we need, and you're pushing on an open door. Now, this from a regime that 1 year earlier would not return a phone call or a letter. So it's just a really remarkable turnaround, but it's a work in progress, and there's a lot more that needs to be done in order to consolidate these reforms and also make sure that there's no backsliding. The way that the constitution of Burma is constructed is really prohibitive to meaningful constitutional reform. 25% of the seats are reserved for the military. 75% of the seats are reserved for the military, and it takes three-quarters of the vote to change the constitution. So if you want to have any constitutional reform, you have to have the military on board. In the constitution, there are provisions for emergency power that are arbitrary and don't require any legislative authorization. The parliament doesn't have any power to override decrees of the National Security Council or of the president. And Article 120 of the Constitution prohibits anyone from holding public office who was imprisoned or who was in exile. So there's a lot of areas of legal and constitutional reform that need to occur in order for Burma to be able to evolve further. There are also sort of a whole package of catch-all state of emergency laws that have been used in the past as draconian measures to suppress civil society, mobilization, the 88 generation, which was protesting after elections, ended up in jail, or many disappeared. When the monks came out to the streets to protest some years ago, these emergency laws were also used to crack down on the Theravada leadership and the seminaries so that they were no longer able to function as effective centers of opposition. There are unlawful association laws. So if you were to speak to some of our colleagues in the law faculty, they could go through chapter and verse of the measures in the Constitution and statutory measures that are far from in accord with international human rights standards. So we have to keep in mind that the legal infrastructure is still in place for the military junta to make a comeback if it wishes to. Colombia, she congratulated the regime for its progress, but she also warned about backsliding, particularly with elections coming up, presidential elections in 2015. This is really going to be the litmus test for how far Burma is going to let this reform process go. Regulations that are prohibitive, and just some facts of doing business that make it hard for international investors to operate there. A high cost of land and property is prohibitive. High exchange rates, high borrowing costs. The banking system is nascent. So local Burmese businesses that seek credit in order to do economic development have a hard time accessing capital. I'd say that probably the greatest obstacle is the lack of trust that exists. You don't automatically, after 40 years of a dictatorship, just turn the page and forget all about the dissidents who disappeared and all the conflicts that have existed in the society. You know, as I'm sure the FT article points out this morning, there are questions about whether the government of Myanmar has a sustaining commitment to liberalization. It should be judged by what it does, not by what it says. And I'd say the jury is still out during these next couple of years leading up to the presidential election as to how far it's really prepared to go. There are also serious and ongoing conflict with ethnic groups in Burma. There are 11 different primary ethnic groups that are part of something called the United Nationalities Federal Council, and 10 of them have entered into ceasefire agreements with the Burmese government. But those ceasefire agreements haven't been transformed into permanent peace agreements. And one of the groups, the Kachin Independence Army, has refused to enter into a ceasefire agreement. They see it as a way of actually undermining their position at the negotiating table. And in the midst of all of this progress and reforms, you all probably heard a good deal in December and January of the military ramping up attack against the Kachin territories on the China border. They were using helicopter gunships and fixed-wing aircraft. There were 100,000 people displaced as a result of that. When I was in Chiang Mai in February, I had a chance to meet with the Kachin negotiating leadership, talk to them a little bit about their negotiations with the government. The good news is that there was a meeting on the 5th of February and another one last week. So the level of tension has been reduced. There still is no ceasefire. There will be another meeting on the 10th of April. But the level of conflict in Kachin State is really a worrisome development. And because there's a sense of solidarity among the ethnic groups, if that situation were to worsen, it's quite likely that some of the other ethnic groups might suspend their ceasefire commitments, and you could see a resumption of violence around the country. So I think that is really a major wild card in Burma's development. You can have a constitutional reform process that enshrines human rights, but if you don't have a parallel set of reforms that distribute power from the central government to the regions, it's very likely that the whole process of liberalization can stall. So there is a big challenge to dealing with the ethnic groups who have gotten use and who profit from conflict now going on for many, many years. So I wanted to give you some broad brushstrokes about what's going on, what some of the challenges are, and also to talk a little bit about how a modest institution like Columbia has been able to try to respond to that. When Dasu came to the university, there were a lot of faculty who were enthused by her presentation and who asked what they could do. So with some assistance from a private grant maker, we were able to launch a Myanmar assistance program. And what we decided to do, rather than focus on a specific area, was to spend as much of this rather generous grant as quickly as possible and engage a kind of system-wide response, to use the term that Anna used and to which we refer. So in the month of February when I was there, there were 8 different faculty members with me. We were doing negotiations training for the government peace negotiators. We were also asked by the UNFC to go to Thailand, and they pulled people out of the jungle from the Thai-Burma border, and we did the exact same negotiations training for them there. In addition to that, we had a series of seminars on constitutional issues. We did that in response to a request from the Rule of Law Committee, which Aung San Suu Kyi chairs. We also did it with a group called Myanmar Egress, which is a governmental body. The fact that we've been able to do these training programs, in a sense, on both sides of the tennis court, being transparent with all, but providing the same information to people who are approaching similar sets of problems from different perspectives, I think has reflected favorably on Colombia's potential contribution. We've also looking at taking our master's degree program from the journalism school and transplanting it to a department of journalism, which is being established at Yangon University. There are faculty from the law school with areas of expertise that have interest in going to Burma and lecturing there. We'd like to bring Burmese faculty to the law school. We'd like to organize scholarships and fellowships for Burmese to come here and for Columbia students to go there. There's a serious public health challenge in Burma, including issues around child trafficking and HIV/AIDS. So we had a group from our Mailman School of Public Health go and look at institutional and capacity building for their Ministry of Health. And we've just been able to get access at the highest levels of the government, of the opposition, and with the opposition. So being able to work with all of these different sectors has put us in a good position to share some of our expertise and hopefully contribute to Burma's progress. When you go there, you'll probably have a chance through your impact assessments to meet people, go out into the field. We've done a fairly broad set of assessments in different sectors. We've been building relationships with people, and we'd be more than happy to share some of those names and introductions with you. So I hope that this overview is useful, and it'd be good if we could have a discussion and explore a little bit about things that you might do and things that we might do together. But thank you, Anna.
Thank you, David. That was extremely helpful. I think we now open the floor if we have questions for David. What I would like to ask, if you can introduce yourself, tell a little bit where you're coming from, that helps David, but also then the new YGLs that we have in the room. So, Valerie.
Yes, thank you so much, Anu, for convening this, and David, for giving your time and sharing your insights. My name is Valerie Keller. I'm a fellow at Said Business School at Oxford University. I was curious if you could talk a little bit about the soul of the people there. Like, how has the impact of this kind of reform opening up impacted kind of the culture and the values? It's a very spiritual culture, theoretically, right? But now that you've created this new space, I'm really curious about what is the sense of the people? Because if the reason why there was an opening was because you think there was a lot of external pressure and there was some internal champions, then now that external pressure has kind of gone away, and now you have the potential question about can those internal champions now become nation builders, right, and people builders, I'm looking for kind of a sense of, is there a sense of people power? Do people feel neutered and beaten down, or is there kind of an industriousness and a can-do spirit, and it's just needed to have air and oxygen to breathe? That's kind of the general sense, of kind of the milieu, the put your finger on the pulse of the people. Because I think, you know, when we think about Burma's future and the potential to prevent the backsliding, to me, I look to say, what is the will of the people, and is there a strong will? Is there a sense of people, since you've got these different ethnic groups, and is there a potential for those ethnic groups to turn on themselves, like we've seen in other nation states where the strong government presence has shifted, and then now you've got a lot of internal fighting? So if you could just talk a little bit about that would be great.
So the symbol of the will of the people has been Aung San Suu Kyi. And when she was in house arrest, and she became a mythical figure, when she was let out of the Rose Garden and back onto the street, suddenly there are new sets of challenges to her personally and to her party. You probably saw some press reports over the weekend about the NLD convention and how it was rather chaotic. There was a gap in its leadership. And there's something called the 88 generation, who were the dissidents and the students who protested when elections were annulled. There's now this kind of lost generation since 1988. So the middle-level management around the NLD essentially just doesn't exist, doesn't have capacity. So there's a lot of enthusiasm for reform, but you also have a civil society that lives in an entirely suppressed environment. So how they manifest their enthusiasm is a big challenge. There's a very well-known human rights organization that's led by some of the 88 generation figures. And you know, I was just so taken by them. They were really the pure spirit of human rights. And I had the opportunity of channeling some resources from a donor country to human rights groups on the ground. When I started to explore with them how we could work together, I found they had no registration, no bank account, no administrative system. So even if we had the money in hand and we were wanting to transfer it, there's just no system of accountability. There's no business practice there. So it's going to take a lot of effort to recover this lost generation. And on a one-to-one level, on an institutional level, there are things that, you know, we all can do. I think Aung San Suu Kyi as well is in a little bit of a predicament because she's now a political leader. When she was at Columbia, she was asked if she wanted to become president. She was rather coy at that meeting, saying, well, I don't rule it in, I don't rule it out. Since then, she's ruled it in. And in order for that to happen, there needs to be a reform of an item in the Constitution that prevents any Burmese citizen who has been married to a foreigner, had a foreigner spouse, or children who are foreigner citizens from holding the top spot. So in order for that reform to happen, she needs the cooperation of the military. So she's very much entered into a cooperative arrangement with the military. Her father, General Aung San, was a military man, and she speaks rather fondly of how she likes men in uniform because she grew up with pictures of men in uniform around the house. So she's on a little bit of a tightrope now, trying to balance all these different competing demands from the 88 generation, from the junta, from people that are in power and still control the country's outcome. You know, on your question about the ethnic groups turning on themselves, you know, it is true that in every post-conflict country, there are always divisions. And when you have armed groups that are transforming into political parties, there are lots of tensions. There was a lot of money made on narcotics trade and weapons trade over many years. So doing disarmament and demobilization, reintegration, isn't a process that happens overnight. But I'd say that on the whole, there's a lot of solidarity among the ethnic groups. You know, they're approaching it as a body. They are committed to a political dialogue with the government. This umbrella organization, the UNFC that I mentioned, seems to be at the table whenever there are meetings with the Kachin Independence Army. Its leader is the chair of the UNFC, and there seems to be a lot of ethnic solidarity among the different groups. So I don't see the immediate prospect of those groups turning on each other, but you know, the closer that they get to peace deals, the more spoilers will emerge. You know, that's always the case. It's just important to be able to understand that and try to head it off before it becomes a more serious problem.
Thank you again for this dialogue. I know I enjoyed it, and David, thank you for your insights. I'm very impressed by the intervention of Colombia in such a short time frame. I also saw Aung San Suu last year, and definitely by far she was one of the most impressive people I've seen in years. As I heard your insights and some of the key findings, I couldn't help but compare the trajectory with what happened in South Africa. So I spent 3 months there in 2006. And you can liken Aung Suu to Mandela coming out and the many years that they spent in captivity. And then also with respect to the population and the whole gap of an entire generation that's lost. And as we look back, you know, now over 20 years, you've also seen a descendants from the types of presidents. So you have Mandela, then you have Thabo Mbeki, then you have Jacob Zuma. And I think there might be some key lessons that we can learn from that to apply it to the future of Myanmar such that we don't have the same issues. By the way, I run a renewable energy company called Empowered, and we have some of our solar-powered lights in Myanmar, not as many as we'd like yet. But you know, so from a business perspective, there's a lot of opportunity, but I think Valerie brought up a good point. At the end of the day, it's about the people and really creating that support and strength such that they can carry themselves. So I'd love to hear some of your insights on that and how you're thinking about addressing it from a Columbia perspective and ways that we can be supportive.
A lot in your statement and question. We recognize the importance of working at a grassroots level and empowering people as change agents. So one of the activities that we've taken on with a local partner called Justice for All is to develop a curriculum on international human rights, to relate that curriculum to their domestic human rights aspirations, and to integrate into that a kind of advocacy training. And there's a group of young Burmese lawyers who are, you know, quite, you know, schooled up and quite capable. And with them, we plan to organize over the next 18 months the 24 leadership meetings, not in Yangon only, but around the country, including in Rakhine and some of the ethnic areas. And our target are political activists, young lawyers, but also labor organizers and farmers. Because at a grassroots level, you have to be able to inform people about what are their democratic rights and then give them a voice. So the only way that can really happen effectively is if you have local partners through whom you can work. Now, granted, even the most capable local partner, they need the financial resources to do it. They need some expertise and some management support. So the role that we can play as outsiders is providing some of those discrete assistance items. But ultimately, they have to go into the village. They need to be able to talk to people and organize them so they become a kind of sinew connecting civil society to parliament and policymakers so that there's effective change at a public policy level. While it's important to focus on the civil society, you know, I want to sort of draw us back to South Africa. What's similar between South Africa and Burma is that both countries are blessed with leaders of enormous stature. And you know, clearly the leadership rating fell off a lot after Mandela, but Mandela and Aung San Suu Kyi are really in categories of their own. Dalai Lama and a few others I would kind of put in that level of stature. South Africa, they decided the need to address historical grievances head on. And South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission was unique in this process of truth-telling because it allowed not only the victim but the perpetrator to engage in a truth-telling process. And it offered amnesty to the abusers of human rights. Now, that was an innovation in the whole area of global truth-telling. DASU seems to be much more focused on the present and the future. And I think this is also a factor that goes into her negotiations with the military. What she has highlighted is the importance of looking forward. Now, any kind of historical narrative is clearly going to highlight abuses by the military regime. And with the transition still underway, going through a fragile period, it's important to be strategic as you develop a dialogue about truth and reconciliation. You talked about South Africa and its importance. What I want to underscore is the need for a kind of South-South dialogue. It's fine for Columbia as a leading Western institution to go there and for its faculty to be involved in different projects, but when you have people from the region or from the Southern Hemisphere that are working with Burmese partners, it resonates in an entirely different way. And I believe that the country of Indonesia has an especially important role to play. When Indonesia went through its democratic reform process, there were also prohibitive numbers of seats in the parliament allocated to the military. And those seat allocations were gradually reduced, and now there are no dedicated seats in the Indonesian parliament to the military. So one of the things that we want to do is to bring people from the government to Jakarta and study there how Indonesia established civil-military relations as part of its democratic transition. I also did some work over the years in northern Sumatra in Aceh. And there you had the Free Aceh movement transforming itself from an armed insurgency into a political party and taking over the governorship and the political leadership of Aceh province as part of a broader negotiation around decentralization and special autonomy. So we have plans to take the UNFC, you know, from the Thai-Burma border to Aceh and have them meet with the leaders of the Free Aceh movement and talk to them about how they transition from an armed rebel group into a political stakeholder. So that kind of South-South connection is very important.
There in the back, please. Sorry, I don't know your name.
Neil Blumenthal. I started a company called Warby Parker that sells fashionable glasses for a fraction of the price. And I used to train low-income women to start their own businesses selling glasses in the developing world, particularly in South Asia. It's exceedingly rare that existing leadership takes such drastic change, and I was hoping that you could talk a little bit more in detail about that decision to open up. And then is there, in your experience, have you seen, is there sort of a formula on how do you keep sort of existing stakeholders that have power sort of happy so that way to prevent sort of backsliding? Is it incremental change rather than sort of trying to yank as much authority as possible from sort of the existing power brokers?
One of the things that we're doing with the Women's Refugee Commission is livelihoods training for women. So maybe I can introduce you to the Women's Refugee Commission. Maybe there is an eyeglass industry to emerge. Now, on the subject of what happened to inspire this strategic pivot, I don't think that the answer is quite clear. There are probably a combination of factors. We talked about a few during the introduction. The need to diversify the portfolio, economic incentive, the kind of psychology that comes from being outcast and isolated. I think, too, that Burma became so overly reliant on China. And they watched China's model of development in Africa, where it would go in, plunder resources, not reinvest, and then extract without creating jobs or building any kind of sustainable development. And they realized that they were on that course. So clearly China has a huge role to play. These negotiations between the government of Myanmar and the Kachin Independence Army are actually hosted by the Chinese government in a Chinese village on the Burma-China border. So, you know, they're in the neighborhood. They are clearly stakeholders. But I think that the governments recognize that over the long term, they want to have a diversified portfolio where the Chinese are players, but also where the EU, which has suspended its sanctions, and the U.S., which has done the same, also are open, not only for markets, but as investors.
Thank you.
Morning. Thank you so much again for coming. My name is Jill. I'm a trader at JP Morgan. I have two questions, one about scale and the other one about sanctions and international pressure. So the scale question is the Burmese economy has an additional challenge in the sense that it's a very, very small economy, and the development model for that particular size of an economy is also very distinct. You know, so in many ways, the South Africa-Burma Burmese comparison is interesting, I would say, on the political and civil society front, but from an economic point of view, there's an additional set of challenges. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what they're doing to think about, you know, specific models given the challenge of scalability for Burma. And you mentioned China, you know, as being also a challenge there in terms of the relationship and the disparity in size. And then my question about sanctions is I'm very skeptical in general about the power of sanctions and international pressure. And the entire dialogue around Burma in many ways is also a little bit self-congratulatory in the sense that we're, you know, patting ourselves on the back in terms of the change and what the international pressure has produced. And I was wondering if you could talk a little, as I'm trying to be a little bit controversial here, because I was wondering if you could talk specifically about the idea of international pressure and the sanction model that has so often failed, you know, North Korea, Cuba, Iran, so often failed. And it worked in South Africa, you know, to a certain extent, and we think it worked in Burma, but But what were, you know, the real differences? Was it leadership, like we were saying, Mandela? You know, you mentioned Mandela and Sun Tzu Chi, like, were really exceptional leaders. Could you talk a little bit more about just the idea and the model of sanctioned international pressure and regime change and what we've learned, really learned, and if it was really international pressure and sanctions that made the difference?
So your question about sanctions is one of my favorites. So I can't wait to answer, but let me just speak about the kind of scaling up the economic model. Burma is not an industrialized economy. Its manufacturing base is small. I think its largest export product are flip-flops to Europe. So that gives you a sense of scale. It is an extremely resource-rich country, and you know, it has forests, it has teak wood, there are a lot of minerals. So even though Burma's economy is small today, once they start extracting those natural resources, it's likely to grow considerably. When there was recently a donors conference in for Burma, I was with a senior Burmese official and the day of the donors conference, and I said, you know, how's it going? What are you expecting? He said, we don't really have very high expectations. And I said, why? There's such enthusiasm for Burma. He said, because we're begging using a golden rice bowl, which to me was a very telling comment. You know, the perception of Burma internationally is that it's not going to grow because of foreign aid. It's going to grow because it has this very natural, this rich natural resource base and a significant population. So in the future, I think you're going to see a, you know, very steep economic growth curve. So on the subject of sanctions, you put a lot of questions into a few sentences, and you sort of brought into the discussion this question of regime change. I would push back a little bit. I think that sanctions can be an effective tool, not necessarily for regime change, but for changing the behavior of a regime. And I think that if you approach it that way, that you've set your goals more realistically, so you don't have quite as great a gap to cover. Sanctions as a kind of dull instrument have been proven ineffective, which is why over time we've refined this concept of smart sanctions, which target the regime and its inner circle. So they involve travel bans, study bans, visa restrictions, foreign bank accounts, the import of certain luxury goods, so that it really affects the inner circle as opposed to the population as a whole. Ultimately, what you want to do is to use sanctions as a way of drawing distinction between the overall population and this small group of elites. If you use sanctions as a dull instrument, it won't have that effect. And if you implement sanctions bilaterally, you won't be able to achieve your desired objective. You know, in the case of Cuba, we have a Cuban-American lobby which is calling for sanctions. Meanwhile, Cuba is able to trade and interact with every other country in the Western Hemisphere. So all we've done is essentially removed the United States from opportunity, both economic and opportunities to influence culturally and in other ways, the course of events in Cuba. So smart sanctions that are imposed multilaterally can have an effect on changing the behavior of a regime. In the case of Burma, we had sanctions in place for a long period of time, and they were not effective because it was easy for the Burmese to just turn to China and for China to fill the gap that was created by the EU or the US. So you need a lot of international cooperation in the way you design sanctions. It's important for those sanctions regimes to be authorized through the UN Security Council so that there is a unanimous approach to how they're defined and then how they're implemented. And I think that after the United States went to war unilaterally and illegally in Iraq, this whole idea of regime change has been discredited. So rather than talk about regime change, we should be talking about changing the behavior of regimes. And we shouldn't use Chapter 7 resolutions as a kind of Trojan horse for trying to decapitate a leadership. And when Muammar Gaddafi threatened Benghazi and said he was going to go house to house and kill everyone, the Security Council passed a Chapter 7 resolution authorizing NATO's use of all necessary measures. That resolution was used, in fact, to remove Gaddafi. And, you know, China and Russia, who are really the kind of axis of sovereignty at the UN, subsequently responded indignantly and vetoed three Security Council resolutions on Syria that would have ratcheted up pressure on the regime. So, you know, these international events are all linked. I think it's important to work multilaterally and with consensus and to be very clear about your objectives and the end states so that there are no surprises, then you're more likely to be able to achieve the desired objective.
Yes, there in the middle, please.
Hi, Angela Sun from Bloomberg. Can you talk a bit about the role of media in bringing about political and economic reform and whether there is more transparency on some of the issues that we've talked about? Last year when Aung San Suu Kyi spoke, she said that it was rare that she would ever turn on the television during her years of house arrest because it was simply a vehicle for propaganda. And has that changed meaningfully at all?
So our journalism school is looking at areas of cooperation, and we've done an assessment of different media opportunities in Burma. We were told there was a media department at Yangon University. When we went to meet with them, we found people to meet with, but there really was no department. There were no students and there was no faculty. So this idea of creating an independent media that is part of holding the government to account is clearly consistent with human rights and democratic norms, but it's a process that takes a lot of time. You know, we saw with the monks' protest the use of social media as an organizing tool. But we've also seen how governments adapt to that and how they shut down communication systems. And governments also learn from one another. When there were protests in the ethnic Tibetan areas of Western China, and China learned from Burma's experience dealing with the monks and reacted much more proactively in shutting down communications towers and essentially isolating pro-democracy demonstrators from one another. So there's a lot of ground to make up. There is an increasingly active civil society that's clamoring for independent media. You know, we're studying that. We're trying to evaluate how credible some of those collaborative projects are. But, you know, you're right to ask an important question. Without an independent media, you don't hold a government transitioning to democracy to account. And you also don't have use of the media to spotlight on cronyism and corruption, which also has a very corrosive effect on democratic development.
Just to pick up on the when you mentioned that in the university there is a department for media but no students, no faculty, I think it's not only media in many other areas of the university because that's where the sources of resistance were, that's where the protests would have been formed. So a lot of the students were sent in a very decentralized way in other parts of the country so that there is no campus life, so that they don't get together and potentially then work against the government. So I think that is a big challenge also trying to work with the universities.
That we found, Anu, is just getting appointments with people was a challenge. Because under the old system, nobody was allowed to meet with a foreigner. And now that restriction's been lifted. But there's still this mentality that, you know, if somebody from Colombia sends you an email or makes a phone call, you can't respond because of prohibitions on international contact. So, you know, we needed in some instances to, like, go to the president's office to get the health minister to agree to receive our health fact-finding team. So the logistical challenge to getting things done is serious.
And I want us to get soon to that practical question, because I'm so impressed with the number of meetings, the caliber of meetings you managed to pull together within a week. And it's something that this group that is very impact-oriented and really willing to make sure that we get the right people there, and I want us to get there too to learn how to make that happen. But I think we have time probably for one more question there, and then we turn to Sam and focus on thinking about what we should do with our expertise and how we can weigh in.
David, what do you think is the chance we're all getting used? Like, they'll have a thin sheen as civil society, but when it comes to resource exploitation, narcotics trafficking, it's just going to be business as usual.
So that's a legitimate concern. And it gets back to the question of motivation. Why did the military regime decide to open up to the West? They might have calculated that there are some short-term immediate benefits, economically and politically, that they can derive. But I don't think that it's possible to calculate the dynamic that occurs when you start a process of opening up a society. And right now, you know, there are a lot of individuals and groups who are exercising these newly found freedoms. And once that process gets underway, I don't think you can just roll it back. In order to roll it back, you have to really crack down using all your security services. You'd have to go and arrest opposition leaders. If there was ever a contest that ended up in dispute between the NLD and the government, can you imagine the outcry in society as a whole if Aung San Suu Kyi was not allowed to operate freely? So they might have made a calculation they can get away with some short-term benefits and not really transform the society, but you know, I think that once you build momentum, you know, that becomes hard to reverse. And it's precisely for that reason that we put a full-court press on. We had Dawsu come to Colombia on September 22nd. By January 1, we banked a six-figure grant from a private foundation, and by the first week of February, we had 8 faculty on the ground. I think that the general modus operandi that we're pursuing and the international community is pursuing is to get as much done as soon as possible so you can build momentum and make this process irreversible.
Thank you. So I want to turn it now over to fellow YGL Sam. So Sam and Binta and I have held various conversations trying to figure out the way forward for the YGL group. We had a very productive call with a broader group a while ago, and we got some helpful impact. I think one of the key challenges for us has been that we've understood that the demand is great, but there are also a lot of people supplying the help and assistance, and tried to figure out then how to prioritize, how to have a focused, impactful contribution, how to best sort of draw on the capabilities of this community, and then how to make sure that we are complementing rather than sort of replicating what is already being done on the ground. But if, Sam, you can share a little bit of the thoughts, then we would love to hear everybody else's thoughts and also then David's views on whether you think we're heading to the right direction, what we should keep in mind, watch for, and how to potentially then scale what we have in mind.
Great. Let me briefly introduce myself. I'm Sam Gregory, and I'm a program director at the Human Rights Group Witness and a longtime activist and engaged on Burma. And David, I really appreciated your sort of overview of the situation, recognizing both the moment of openness, but also the risk. I would just note before we go into the discussion, there's two other risks we've been seeing a lot. One is around the sectarian violence in the Rohingya area, and also the issue of land rights has been coming up a lot from the grassroots human rights group we work with, and we worry about both of those as threats to this openness. But the area that I think is really we want to pick up on as a YGL group is how do we provide support? We're an incredibly diverse network, including many members from the Global South, going to your point around South-South dialogue, with a really diverse set of experience. And also, as you said, there is this in some sense, missing generation of support in civil society in Burma, Myanmar. So people who have not had access to networks, not had access to university, not had access to capital. So how do we think about the opportunity to connect the YGL network to people in Burma who have not had that access? So not perhaps just the successor people who've come out of the previous junta or people who've had access before, but some of those emerging groups or the groups that haven't had access. And we've had a couple of ideas which we want to put out to the group, but also welcome your feedback. One is to think in terms of really more loose connections of mentoring and networks, really trying to think about what are those discrete blocks of assistance that individual YGLs grouped in different sectors can provide. One mechanism for making that connection is, of course, the YGL impact journeys, and Shun from the YGL team has been meeting with a whole range of civil society groups in Burma that range from, you know, more established groups who are thinking about policy to new businesses, social entrepreneurship, arts, education, and human rights groups. So there's one entry point there for people to make those mentoring and network connections. And then the other entry point is to think about some of the YGLs who are already doing really quite concrete initiatives themselves. Obviously, Anu has involved herself with the Columbia Initiative. There are also things around rule of law and health. So those are two directions we're thinking. And what we really want to do is to make sure, you know, this is a very unique moment in Burma, and one where there, we actually think there's some urgency, as you said in response to the final question, that this is perhaps not irreversible, and a lot of what we've got to do here is put the input and provide the support now. At the same time, we're very cognizant there's a lot of people coming to make asks. So there's an open door, but it may be swinging in, and people don't know what to do with the support in some sense, because not the infrastructure, there's not the capacity, there's not the sense of how to deal with it. So I think a question to you and then to the YGLs, those two areas of building those mentoring connections and network access connections on a one-to-one basis and supporting projects, how could we do that best? Are there mechanisms you would suggest? And YGLs, obviously, will be reaching out in the next week to the broader YGL community with a really clear ask around this. But we'd love feedback as we fine-tune that so we can get people prepared now that we're about two and a half months out.
If I can add a little bit, so the one idea that we thought about is that we could be, in a way, they link to the world and link to the networks that they previously haven't been connected to. But one question is whether you think they have the capacity to absorb and make a good use of the kind of mentoring and the kind of connection, whether we could be the bridge to the world, if you like to think about it that way, and sort of what are the various challenges, starting from linguistic challenges, very practical challenges, reaching out, identifying those people, going to my earlier comment, how you've been very skillful in identifying partners, reaching out to them, drawing them in, and getting that kind of process going. So in the spirit of what we have been thinking, any thoughts and advice would be welcome.
Let me answer your question last, but I'm really glad that you mentioned the Rohingya problem. It was an omission on my part not to have highlighted it. And what we saw in June and September was essentially an ethnic cleansing of Muslim Rohingya, originally from West Bengal, who don't have any citizenship rights. Now, the 1982 citizenship law doesn't allow them to be citizens of Burma, so those few rights that citizens have had, Rohingya are not eligible for. So one of the ways that we tried to respond to that is that we've drafted a curriculum on social harmony for the Ministry of Higher Education in Sri Lanka. And we've brought our religion department into it, and they've reinterpreted the curriculum based on the Pali Canon and Theravada Buddhist teaching. And we had my old Sanskrit poetry professor, Bob Thurman, go and present the curriculum to the seminary and Buddhist leaders with the idea of trying to train and transfer it, recognizing that the Buddhists in Burma are hardliners and nationalists and the source of the problem. They're part of the problem. They need to also be a part of the solution. But I thank you for calling our attention to the Rohingya issue. The other thing that really didn't come up but briefly is the role of women. And women as peace builders are essential. The Security Council Resolution 1325 describes in detail a role for women in post-conflict situations. So in order to try to inform a national dialogue on 1325, we're going to sponsor a large women's initiative. We're going to have Michelle Bachelet from UN Women go as one of the conveners, and we're going to bring Lema Bowie, was the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize winner, as a kind of inspirational model for how women in Liberia were able to organize and become real change agent. And there is already a well-developed network of women in Burma. So if you're looking to find contact, develop mentoring relationships, you know, looking at some of these broader issues through a gender lens and finding women's groups to work with, you know, is one way of getting that done. They have a lot of capacity. I think, Anna, you put your finger on like a very important problem, which is the short list of people to work with. And there are probably four or five Western-educated PhDs around the president and a group of senior advisors who are just working 24/7 on everything. In civil society, you know, there's a short list of people that foreigners call when they come to town, and they're just totally overwhelmed. So, you know, here we have a kind of chicken and egg problem. You're trying to build local capacity. There are few people who really can engage meaningfully. So how do you find them? How do you do it in a way that isn't intrusive, but actually helpful? I think that, you know, these kind of parachute visits, of which Colombia is guilty, have limited impact, but you know, not negligible. You know, what's especially useful is this kind of long-term mentoring approach, Sam, that you talked about, and also taking Burmese out of the country and giving them the chance to develop international networks that they can then draw on. So finding scholarship opportunities or bringing them into international organizations is one way of getting their skill sets up to international standard and really empowering them as a new generation of leaders so they can go back and make a difference.
Great. Any thoughts from the rest of you on how we as a community should move forward? Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very interesting comments. One issue that we kind of touched upon with I can't remember your name. I'm sorry. With your comments is about basically economic policy making. At the end of the day, whatever peace you establish, whatever rights you establish, is not going to be sustainable in the long run unless we can have economic growth that will make everything sustainable and, you know, self-perpetuating. I was wondering, we all hear a lot about the issues in Burma and the thoughts of Aung San Suu Kyi, but I've never heard about what she or her entourage thinks about economic development. And the Chinese example is interesting, and obviously they have a huge impact, but it's a state-led type of growth. And the example that we follow in the United States is a very different example about private property, about, enforcing contracts, about economic rights, economic freedoms that will, you know, allow them to address a lot of issues like land rights in the long run, maybe minority rights. You know, it kind of overwhelms everything, in my opinion. Economics always overwhelms politics in the long run. So I was wondering whether we can, whether World Economic Forum could help us kind of get together with economic policy thinkers in the society, if at all. I mean, I don't know even if they exist or not, frankly, and talk to them about economic models, about how nations build wealth, how they can, you know, they have to allow international investors into the country to build a very essential infrastructure, how we can put in ironclad private property laws, which is very different from the Chinese model. It's how can we get the private industries start generating wealth for their citizens, things of this nature. What can we do on this front?
So on the subject of Aung San Suu Kyi's view towards economic development, she's all for it. For economic development. In an emerging democracy where free market concepts are new, those questions still are unanswered. So when President Thein Sein was here, he was engaging in these political reforms. He wanted to be able to show that as a result of that, the U.S. had lifted sanctions. In order to get the political cover for that, Aung San Suu Kyi had to call for the lifting of sanctions. And then during their visit to the United States in September, that happened. So it has both a lot of practical as well as symbolic value. Now, on defining the sets of questions that you raised, I think it would be very useful during your trip, especially kind of the impact part of it, to identify specific themes and to kind of cluster the expertise of your YGLers. You know, find clusters of Burmese that are studying or working in similar areas, and then structure a dialogue around those issues. not a seminar where you're coming there to kind of give a tutorial, not them doing a dog and pony show about everything that they're doing, but a real dialogue around the list of questions that you just raised. The question of property rights could be another one. You know, the question of women's role in political mobilization is a third. You know, it's easy to come up with relevant topics. But as far as structuring your trip so that you can learn as much as possible and also make a contribution, I think that, you know, to make a list of the topics where you have expertise, to find small numbers of Burmese that are really working in that area, and then to kind of sit down in a conference room and have a dialogue, do some field assessments jointly, and talk about ways that you can work together beyond exchanging views would be an extremely worthwhile contribution.
I think David is capturing a lot of the YGL spirit also in his guidance of how we go about issues, so thank you for that. I think we have probably time for one more question, comment, and I'm conscious of everybody's busy days ahead. Jill.
You know, that you have perhaps engaged, you mentioned three or four of them already today, you know, women's groups, et cetera, because, you know, we sit on so many boards, we do so many things, and it could be just really practical to have a list of, here are the guys doing things, and, you know, we've worked with them, we have a relationship, whatever, and it could be, you know, five, six, ten, whatever number it is, but it really help orient what you were saying, you know, the groupings of people, and then also, oh, okay, well, you know, I sit on the board of Planned Parenthood. Maybe help create a link with, you know, reproductive women's issue things, like, you know, at the grassroots level and locally, you know. And that's just one example, or glasses and connecting with women and entrepreneurs. So is that something like concrete that we can maybe do and circulate and then get YGLs to sort of sign up and think about ways in which they can create connections and linkages?
So the first thing that you do when you enter a country is you kind of map the field. And that means identifying who are the local partners, doing some qualitative assessment on the nature of their work and the impact of their work, as well as the engagement of the international community, especially the donor community. So as part of the assessments that we've done, and we've concentrated on identifying local partners. I'd be happy to provide to Anu our list of local partners. And that's organized kind of thematically. So in that list, there will be a grouping of the women's organizations, including those who are working on reproductive health issues. There'll be a group working on HIV/AIDS and the public health sector. People that are working on media-related issues. And in some instances, we've done internal papers as part of that mapping exercise, which are not published, but which I'd be happy to share with Anu, so that on a demand basis, you know, you could try to benefit from that. I also think that, you know, part of the reason why I was keen to join you this morning, Columbia is a big university with a lot of goals, but, you know, we have limited capacity and resources as well. So where there's overlapping interest, you know, there is an opportunity for these programs that we're developing, you know, all of which are still notional and just now reaching critical mass, and people like yourself and your colleagues to get engaged and to provide the energy and enthusiasm and help scale up things that we are working on. So, you know, that is an approach that we're taking across the board. We want to be transparent, open, emphasize partnerships in-country, internationally. The fact that you have Anu as an active member and that we are joint faculty members makes it easy for us to collaborate, and we'd welcome that chance.
And as a note on that sort of list compilation, within the WEF team, they've also been doing that with input from different YGLs, and that we want to step up as well and work out who the YGLs are already working with. And it's great to hear there's that list as well, because I think that's really the basis for working out how you establish those linkages and how you...
I would just go about it in a kind of thematic way. So, you know, we've talked about some themes where clearly there's need, where there's demand. You are accessed. You represent a network or have access to networks with resources and skills, and build it around specific outcomes. Because as I was told by the U.S. ambassador on my first trip, the Burmese are just getting assessed to death. You had so many people coming. And I think, you know, maybe just in closing, you know, to emphasize Sam's point, you know, Burma right now is a destination. And you can't even get a hotel room in Burma for several months down the road. If we had a project that we needed to do in 2 weeks, we wouldn't have any place to put our people. And all of the transactions are cash. So unless you have somebody there that's putting cash at the concierge desk, you can't even book a room. So they are overwhelmed with good intentions. What's important is to focus on deliverables and ways that you can really make a measurable difference. So that's been our method. And I think as we explore collaboration, we should try to highlight that.
And that's a wonderful thing to close on. Thank you so much for your time, David. Thanks, everyone.